We're talking about shipwreck explorations to help comprehend the global slave trade, how the relics help form living stories today of marginalized communities. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And this conversation, it reminds me that nearly 5 years ago, my kids and I were down in the Florida Keys taking a state park tour in those glass-bottom boats in Key Largo and spotting leatherback turtles and really bearing witness to the fragile coral reef there. We were not thinking about the transport of slaves from Africa and the Middle Passage, and what a missed opportunity, right? Our boat tour could have had a much bigger conversation about race, environment, and history. So join in on shipwrecks and this intersection and the African diaspora archaeology, 800-642-1234. Aaliyah Pierce is a spoken word poet, storyteller, and researcher who contributed to National Geographic's podcast series called Into the Depths. Aaliyah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here.
Good morning. We also have Justin Dunavant with us, assistant professor of anthropology at UCLA, co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists, and part of Diving with a Purpose, which we're going to talk about. Justin, welcome to you.
Thank you. Happy to be here as well.
Good morning. Justin, let's start with you. As you've searched for and you've explored these ships, these slave ships that sank in the ocean centuries ago, take us down into the sea, that process, and what you see with the remains of these ships.
Yeah. You know, archaeology is a whole field that we generally associate with the land, but there's a whole other set of practices that occur underwater. There's very few underwater or maritime archaeologists, as we're called, and we actually take our archaeological work with a scuba tank and go underwater and explore our history and heritage as it exists there. When we go underwater, we look for shipwrecks specifically related to the transatlantic slave trade, but we end up finding all kinds of history and heritage. A lot of these wrecks, we say, are akin to plane crashes. So instead of excavating down into the ground, we're often excavating across a distance. And for the transatlantic slave trade specifically, we're looking for evidences and remnants of these ships, which often come in the form of ballast stones, which were used to counterbalance the weight of the ship, as well as timbers that may still exist, you know, 100, 250 years later.
That's so fascinating. How hard is it to find a shipwreck on the ocean floor?
I would say it's like a needle in a haystack, but you might actually have a better chance at finding a needle in a haystack.
Wow.
There are thousands of ships that were involved in this trade. And of course, we know that most of this planet is covered in ocean. So a lot of times we have to pull together resources from archives. We talk to local fisher people. They have information about wrecks. And then we have to go off of deduction. We look at the size of the ship, the size of the wreck, and try to piece together the connections with what we find.
Aaliyah, you're a storyteller and a poet. What are you hoping to learn about the slave trade with your involvement in this project and how it applies to your poetry?
Yeah, great question. In terms of wanting to learn is just what I did not learn in a classroom, right? I grew up in America in our educational system, and I think there's a lot of history that is left out. So for me, I was just really open to the process of learning, and poetry especially gave this unique space to imagine what joy sounded like for these people, what rhythm and movement and communication maybe look like. What does, you know, being underwater as a maritime Black archaeologist look like, right? Is that freedom? Is that reclaiming? So through research, I was able to actually grasp a sense of just experience and understanding and empathy for people and potentially my ancestors, right, who were on this journey and survived this tumultuous journey. And I was able to capture these feelings and emotions and just history and put poetry to it so that now the audience can hopefully have a space to be welcomed in and experience this journey as well.
It brings you closer when you can say their name, and saying their name, you know, is certainly a part of the words and the intention.
Yeah, exactly.
So can you give us some construct to the sheer numbers of people who were taken from Africa, moved across the waters. What can you tell us about those numbers?
Yeah, great question. The numbers are, so this podcast, we really wanted to honor the estimated 1.8 million unsung souls who perished during the Middle Passage. But let's also understand the breadth and intentionality and magnitude of this journey. It was 12.5 million people who were captured and brought to the Americas. 12.5 million people, and then 1.8 million who were lost to the water. So when we think about people who have African ancestry, the necessity to understand history, to understand one's identity and placement in this world, on this land, it is so, so necessary. And this was an intentional journey, and I always make sure to say that. This was a displacement and an insidious erasure of Blackness across continents, countries. So I really always try to make sure that people understand that this was a global institution.
I'm going to reintroduce you both here for a moment. Aaliyah Pierce there, storyteller, educator, poet. Justin Dunavant with us, assistant professor of anthropology at UCLA, co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists. They have been National Geographic explorers, their work documenting the Atlantic slave trade. You can join in with questions, 800-642-1234. Justin, when I hear Aaliyah talk about identity and talk about placemaking, how do you think about the legacy of slavery through that and through marine archaeology? How does that all come together?
Yeah, you know, I got into archaeology specifically wanting to uncover elements of history that weren't written in textbooks. And archaeology provides us with this physical, tangible connection to history. What I've come to learn as I'm doing this work is archaeology at times is often too narrow a term for what it is that we're able to do. I've been telling people now that we're actually working to recover ancestral memory. And this memory in this case is related to my history and also to this wider conversation of African history and American history. But there are archaeologists that cover their own history in other countries and other areas and other worlds. And what we're trying to do is bring this history back into the present so it can inform us in terms of how we're living now and where we can go in the future.
You have this mantra, remember, remind, restore, I think it is. How do you think of those words through this work, through this archaeology?
Yeah, you know, we say remember, remind, and restore. I tell people, you know, as an archaeologist, as somebody who's interested in history, we have to remember the things that we've done in as human beings. Mm-hmm. We have to remind each other of what those things were and how they worked and how they operated. And then we have to begin to restore those practices that are nurturing and rejuvenating to us as human beings.
I really appreciate that. And I can think of how that mantra would really guide you through so many different aspects of the work you do, because it is both on land and underwater. And to me, that would be also two very different types of science. Or is it not? Do you find that your work above, you know, above the water and below the water can kind of come together?
Yeah, you know, they are two very different types of science. But as you brought up, the two are inextricably connected. And part of the work we're trying to do now is just show people how much these two go together. Just because we have land archaeology and underwater archaeology doesn't mean that we have to separate them. Hmm. The land continues into the ocean. Water continues on and underneath the land. And so as we're beginning to do this work, we're looking at not only how we interact with these environments, but how our ancestors interacted with these environments.
National Geographic explorer, archaeologist, scuba diver, instructor for Diving with a Purpose, Justin Dunavant is here, along with spoken word poet Aaliyah Pierce, researcher of oral storytelling, folklore traditions across the African diaspora. Join in on the global search for shipwrecks associated with the Middle Passage of the transatlantic slave trade, how you hold this history today, how you think about it, what you want to know about it. 800-642-1234. More conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. We're learning about the African slave trade, the crimes against humanity that lay on the ocean floor in shipwrecks. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Aaliyah said, there were 12.5 million Africans who were seized, abducted into slavery for centuries. About 1.8 million died in shipwrecks in the Atlantic Ocean. Join in on this history. What do you want to learn through marine archaeological expeditions? 800-642-1234. National Geographic explorer Justin Denevant is an assistant professor of anthropology at UCLA. And Aaliyah Price is here, spoken word poet, contributed to the Into the Depths podcast. They're here for the hour. And Aaliyah, you wrote some poems for the podcast Into the Depths. One of them focused on the wreck of the slave ship, the pirate ship, the Guerrero. Can you tell us a little bit, give us a sketch of what happened to the Guerrero?
So the Guerrero ran aground. It was a really interesting journey there. I want to make sure I'm getting the information correctly because I did take a step away from the information a bit. I know Justin has some familiarity. Would he like to jump in on this?
Sure. Justin, go ahead with the Guerrero.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So the Guerrero was a slave ship that was involved in the transatlantic slave trade after the transatlantic slave trade was abolished. Mm-hmm. So many people don't know that they actually abolished the trade from Africa to the Americas first, and then later abolished slavery within the U.S. So the ship, the Guerrero, was an illegal voyage, and it was being followed by an anti-slaving ship in 1827. As it's running away, it ends up striking a coral reef and begins to sink. And from that, we then come across what we are looking for now, which is the shipwreck of the Guerrero.
Has it been found yet?
It has not been found. We know that it sank somewhere off the coast of Florida. Mm-hmm. There have been searches that have occurred in National Park Service waters, as well as in NOAA waters. But we're still looking, still trying to identify where it may have its last resting place.
So I'm imagining this pirate ship just being tailed by this other ship patrolling the Florida Straits. And as I understand it, the pirate ship was trying to reach Cuba, was trying to reach Havana. Can you tell us about what was going on with the intent of what this ship wanted to do with these hundreds of enslaved Africans in the hold who probably aren't knowing what's going on, you know, above deck?
Yeah, you know, this whole conversation around slavery gets so complex. We know that the U.S. outlawed the transatlantic slave trade. They stopped these voyages coming in. Slavery continued into places like Cuba and Brazil much longer. And of course, we're talking about British colonialism versus Spanish colonialism versus Portuguese. So there's all kinds of nuances that go into that. The Guerrero had over 500 enslaved Africans on it, and at least 40 of those individuals drowned during this wrecking event. And again, from places like Cuba, they could then be sent to work on plantations in Cuba, or then go out and be sold to all kinds of other Caribbean islands, and then throughout the African diaspora more broadly.
Aaliyah, would you be able to read some of your poem about this wreck?
Absolutely. So for this specific piece, Tara, as well as some of the amazing team members on with Diving and With a Purpose, kind of gave the explanation of what that looked like with the Guerrero. So my part comes in the end, and it's a few lines, but I think it's really important because it actually pulls from literature from Toni Morrison in terms of the Black African, the flying African legend. Mm. And so this idea that, you know, Africans would rather commit, you know, suicide or jump off of slave ships and return home. So let's not think about the death piece, but in terms of in death, I can return home to Africa and I can fly home to Africa. So it really pulls from that legend, and the lines go as so. Imagine if they grew wings, traveled through the sky and returned to Africa. Their soul seeped into the soil to fall in love, to dance, and to have those who love them say their names again.
Mm. That is beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that. What did you think about when you did try to give voice to this history, only knowing like bits and pieces of it, only being able to know perhaps what the research says and what the accounts say of what happened to the Guerrero?
Yeah, it was a lot of like siphoning through material because the stories are more so oral storytelling. So, you know, there are a few amazing anthropologists who have done that work to, you know, grasp and grab these and capture these amazing oral stories. But I think what I was feeling in this moment and thinking was just this idea of joy, a desire to be home on their homeland and with their tribe and their people. And remembering that these captured Africans were engineers. They were warriors. They were teachers. They were all the things just like us, and they had stories and they were storytellers. And so that was my motivating piece throughout all of this, was that they were people just like us, and they deserve their stories to be told, to have their names said. And even if we cannot pinpoint their African name, they at least deserve to be honored in this piece.
Aaliyah Pierce with us, storyteller, educator, and poet. Justin Dunavant is an assistant professor of anthropology at UCLA, co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jack in Madison. Hi, Jack. What would you like to bring up?
Hi there. You know, from what I've heard, listening to you guys on the past couple of minutes, had these really interesting ideas and about sort of the transatlantic slave trade and this whole trend, a lot of which I didn't know, especially since a lot of our perceptions of archaeology come from pop culture and movies like Indiana Jones and whatnot, although there's not much in the way of marine archaeology there. One of the things that stood out to me was hearing Justin talk about the end of the transatlantic slave trade in the U.S., I'm not sure how familiar you are with this, but one of the things I heard about, like why it ended in the U.S., was because of a lot of Southern plantation owners wanting to breed their own slaves and create a nationalized industry out of that, particularly in states like Virginia and the Carolinas. And I wondered, you know, what you guys made of that or how familiar you were with that trend as opposed to continuing the transatlantic slave trade in the United States.
Jack, thank you. Justin.
Yeah, there's a number of different reasons why the transatlantic slave trade was abolished. It's interesting, actually, the Danes were the first European country to abolish the transatlantic slave trade just a couple years before 1807. And then the British followed suit in 1807. People have argued that this is in part because the British had lost so many colonies in the United States. It no longer became profitable for them to continue to promote this idea of slavery, particularly with the voyages and the trading voyages. And then that led to subsequent conversations around abolishing slavery as a whole. At this time, there was also a moral question, there was an ethical question, and there was an economical question going on in Europe about how much money we're sending to colonies, how much debt is going into these colonies, and then the question of actually enslaving human beings. All of these come together to sort of push this idea of eventually abolishing a transatlantic slave trade. One of the issues that we have in the US is that we often look at English archives, but this conversation of abolition was a multinational global discussion. Mm. So there was British talking to Spanish, talking to French, talking to others, which really caused this to proliferate.
Aaliyah, what comes up for you as you think about this? Oh, Aaliyah, can you hear us?
Oh, I'm sorry. There you go. Thank you. I think Justin really hit it on the nose. And I think the main piece, just to reiterate, is that this is an international industry that required financial strain, economic strain, and even just the political pieces that were involved. And so there were many powers to be within this. And so they really had to examine what was economically sustainable and successful for us, right? So I think Justin hit all the points and nothing needs to be reiterated.
Talking with Aaliyah Pierce, helping us with the relationship between enslavement and the forced voyage of enslaved Africans across the Atlantic Ocean, what these shipwrecks reveal. UCLA Assistant Professor of Anthropology and scientific diver Justin Dunavant is here as well. Join in 800-642-1234. We will pick this up. More conversation after a news update on the Ideas Network. We are dropping down into the depths of the Atlantic to get new insights on the African diaspora of the past 500 years through archaeology, the global slave trade of the 16th through 19th centuries. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. UCLA archaeologist Justin Dunavant is here, trains the next generation of scuba divers to do maritime archaeological research. The shipwrecks are a way to uncover stories and history and heritage that are not in the textbooks. Join in with your questions on the discoveries, how it's done, 800-642-1234. We have Justin Dunavant and spoken word poet Aaliyah Pierce who are with us for the hour. Let's bring in another caller. Fatima is with us from Madison. Fatima, what would you like to bring up?
Hi. So my question is, how did we get, like, where did we come from, the people who came from Africa? And my question is because I live in the Gambia for half the year, and the total population there is 2.5 million. Half of that is kids, and then the other half, you know, is obviously half women, half men. And when you're there, you do not hear a story that, oh, you know, almost all of our men were taken in the past. And birth rates were much lower back then, you know, population rates. So how did we get to 12 million people? Where did those men come from?
Justin, can you help with that?
Yeah, certainly. That's a great question. You know, when we're talking about the transatlantic slave trade, there's a couple things to keep in mind. One is that we're talking about a slave trade that started really in the late 1500s, 1600s, all the way into the 1800s. So we're talking about several hundreds of years that this is occurring across. So 12 million people starts to add up over time. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is that these country borders that we know today did not exist as we know them. Therefore, the Gambia, which I actually did archaeology in the Gambia on James Island, which was believed to be the origin of one of the characters from Roots, the Roots narrative. But Gambia and James Island specifically, those are just points of departure. Individuals were coming inland from different parts of Africa, being walked to the coast. Sometimes they would be put on canoes and go further downstream until they reached the coastal destinations. We have accounts of individuals that were coming from Central Africa all the way to the west coast of Africa to be sold throughout the Atlantic Ocean. Also keeping in mind too, that there are times and there are accounts of individuals being captured in South Africa, being sent to the Americas, and even as far as Madagascar, being sent to places like Jamaica and Virginia.
Fatima, does that help? Does that give a little more perspective on that, on
yeah.
that migration, that geography, that forced migration, if you will?
So are you saying that Africans were enslaving other Africans and then selling them to North Americans, but they were like coming from, like, were there North Americans going to East Africa to get these slaves, or were the other Africans selling, you know, other Africans?
Yeah, great question. So one thing I try to do when I, especially when I teach classes, is to dissolve this myth that Africa was a unified continent during this time. Oftentimes I equate it to, you know, World War One, World War Two. If we use that concept, we would say World War Two is just Europeans fighting Europeans. So in some cases, it's a little more nuanced when we look at African slavery. We have different groups that were feuding with each other initially. And then when you inject warfare, you inject weapons, and then you inject economic motivations, it increases the propensity of warfare in these places. So there is that trading that's going on internally in Africa. We also have pirates that are coming along these coasts that are actively trading with people to purchase enslaved Africans. And then we have European governments. The Royal Africa Company coming out of Britain is one of the first quote-unquote companies in the world. And they had a literal monopoly on the transatlantic slave trade for all British colonies. So these major industries start to develop as a result of that and begin to pull people from West Africa, from South Africa, from Southeastern Africa, and sell them throughout the Americas.
Fatima, thank you for that question. Justin, I want to dive down again on a recovery, the Clotilda, which was the last known slave ship to reach America. What can you tell us about your work on this project and this ship?
Yeah, you know, the Clotilda is probably one of the most fascinating stories in the story of the African diaspora. And it is an amazing piece of history, both in America and with relevancy to the African continent. The Clotilda was considered to be the last slave ship to enter the United States. It entered after a bet between a slave owner and a ship captain. In 1860, again, the transatlantic slave trade is made illegal. The ship captain and the slave owner enter into a bet and say that, I bet you can't go to the coast of Africa, purchase a number of individuals, and then sell them back in the United States. Hmm. The captain is actually successful in this voyage, according to his standards, bringing people from what is now modern day Benin into what was then Mobile, Alabama, what is now Mobile, Alabama, and sold those individuals throughout Alabama. The interesting story about all of this is that the Clotilda, this happened 5 years before the transit or before the slave trade in America was abolished. So these individuals were enslaved for a period of about 5 years. Most of their experiences actually occurred, they still had strong recollections of their lives in Africa. So then those individuals who are sold on that ship try to return to the ship after slavery is abolished, the destination of the ship, to be sent back to Africa. When they realize that's not feasible, they begin to purchase land and set up a community called Africatown, just outside of Mobile. And I can get deeper into the recovery of this ship, but just last month we engaged in some excavations there.
Oh, what did you find?
Well, the location of the ship was identified as early as 2019, and a number of individuals had been working to locate it prior to then. People also say that individuals in the community knew the location of the ship. The ship's captain intentionally burned and scuttled or sunk the ship, as we call it, in an attempt to cover up the entire endeavor. As a result of that, it was really resting in the Mobile River. And so our excavations at this stage were really meant to just get a better understanding of the structural integrity of the remains of the ship, the feasibility of potentially doing complete and further excavations, and getting a better understanding of preservation and conservation for a shipwreck of this magnitude.
I'm wondering, Aaliyah, how can, as you hear about the Clotilda or, you know, the Guerrero for that matter, how can the history and the story of a slave ship that is so steeped in oppression, how can that help us in social justice today, in race relations today? How do you make those connections?
I think what's important to remember is this idea of resistance that is often not said, similar to the Clotilda, even the Fredericus Quartus and the Christianus Quintus, which is in episode 3, I believe. We see this, there are constant revolts, and whether a revolt is I'm fighting physically on a ship or even just I am a part of 33 people who survived this and build Africatown in Mobile, Alabama. Resistance and revolt looks different, and it's a wide spectrum. And I think that's our connection. And that's always what I try to share through this storytelling, is that there was resistance in language, in sound, in body, in strategy, with keeping families together, that is a form of resistance, right? Mm. And so I really tried throughout this work to really embody that into the poetry, into any readings I was doing. And I think that's really how it connects to social justice and racial, in our racial kind of sphere right now. It's how are we revolting and resisting? And I think those are the key questions we have to ask.
We're looking at the legacy of slavery with two National Geographic explorers, Aaliyah Pierce, storyteller, educator, and poet, Justin Dunavant here, assistant professor of anthropology at UCLA, co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists. Taking your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Bruno in Madison. Bruno, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, this is a really great discussion. And from my own kind of reading and experience, I've seen that enslaved Africans were also involved in the shipping industry kind of significant ways. And I'm wondering if you all could speak to the history of enslaved Africans working, you know, in the maritime industry, if you have any knowledge about that.
Justin, do you have that type of context through your anthropology?
Certainly, certainly. I encourage individuals to check out a book called Undercurrents of Power by Kevin Dawson. It specifically talks about African engagement in the maritime world. He puts a story in there as early as the 1600s. You have individuals free from Senegal being sent to Europe to help to salvage a shipwreck. And they were sent, they were called upon because the Senegalese were known as some of the most professional free divers in the world. They would often have to dive down and hold their breath for sometimes 6-7 minutes at a time. And they would be responsible for recovering things that were on these ships that sank. That's just one element. When we get into the transatlantic slave trade, we have enslaved individuals who are tasked with working on these ships. Some of them get kidnapped or escape and end up working with pirates. They help with navigating these ships. In some cases, they captain these ships. There's a whole host of fishing that occurs in these areas. Free divers being forced to dive for pearls, as well as mining coral out of the ocean, which is used to build some of the earliest colonial buildings in the Caribbean. It's really a fascinating story. And it often re-centers and reorients our mind to think about just how much of our life and our history occurred on and in the water, as opposed to on land. That was our major highways back then. Anytime we wanted to travel, it was often easier to go by river, by boat, across the oceans and in the seas than it was to go over land.
What you're saying there also brings up the fact that these are all skills. Some are very difficult skills to master, and that, you know, Africans had these skills or acquired them in order to do this work.
Definitely. I think that's critical to keep in mind. And then the ways in which the whole transatlantic slave trade had to allow for caveats and nuances to continue. There were times when they set up laws that said that people would legally be freed when they were on a boat, but then they would legally be re-enslaved when they would touch land. And it had to do with all kinds of laws around the trade in enslaved Africans that were occurring in the 1800s.
UCLA, Justin Dunavant there, and stays with us on these connections to slavery, the slave trade through these sunken slave ships, searching for their histories and the stories of the time. Spoken word poet Aaliyah Pierce stays with us as well. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about the study of sunken slave ships as a lens to uncover stories that could otherwise go forgotten. The National Museum of African American History and Culture, it says this work to humanize the global slave trade increases our capacity to better understand the world we live in today. Still time to talk about maritime archaeology, the scholarship of slavery, the slave trade, 800-642-1234. We have UCLA archaeologist Justin Denevant, co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists, with us. And Aaliyah Pierce is a spoken word poet and contributor to the National Geographic podcast series Into the Depths. Aaliyah, you bring us closer to Harriet Jacobs as part of Into the Depths. Can you tell us about her and escaping on the Maritime Underground Railroad?
Yeah, so Harriet Jacobs was actually one of the most famous African American slaves during the Civil War. During the time of the Civil War and African slaves. She was a woman truly of bravery and virtue, and her book, The Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, is a biography written by Harriet Jacobs, as well as others who have revised it over time. The amazing thing about her was that she actually was born into slavery, what is an issue for many women during this time was that they were subject to much physical, emotional abuse, whether by their enslaver or their enslaver's wife, for example. Mm-hmm. So Harriet Jacobs actually had a very happy childhood. She grew up with her family to an extent, and then she was then forced sexually and physically in many ways. And so her family actually, because of this harassment, hid her for 7 years in the attic of their house. So she was seeing her children through cracks in the attic. She was witnessing all of this, and so she escaped, and she actually went through Maritime, and she had the assistance of other Black ship owners and those who were part of the Maritime journey, and they assisted her to freedom. Yeah.
Justin, what comes up for you as you think about Harriet's story?
You know, I think that, and many authors have written about this, but it's just the spaces in which we had to inhabit in order to make life or to sustain life in a place like America during the point of slavery. I mean, to me, this is, you know, we grow up learning about Anne Frank in the school system. Mm-hmm. This is a woman who had to live 7 years of her life in an attic. Literally, if she got caught, she could be killed. It's just a mind-boggling sort of notion and story. And, you know, as an archaeologist, what we try to do is recover these stories. And so Harriet Jacobs is just one of probably, you know, 20, 30, maybe even 40 other Harriet Jacobs or Harriet Jacob-like narratives out there of individuals who had to, like Henry Box Brown, for example, literally construct a box and physically ship himself from the South into the North to achieve emancipation. So there's all these narratives that come up for me. When I hear one story, it leads me to 10, 20 others.
I don't want this hour to get by without you being able to talk about diving with a purpose and trying to teach diving and carrying on this work of maritime archaeology, spreading it to others. Can you take us into this type of project and what you're trying to work on here?
Yeah, thank you, Kate. Yes, Diving with a Purpose is a nonprofit organization. It was founded by members of the National Association of Black Scuba Divers and individuals of a number of other organizations. And it developed specifically initially to search for this slave ship, the Guerrero, which was mentioned earlier. These are professionally trained scuba divers. They're recreational scuba divers, but they've been doing diving so long that they've actually gotten the skills to be professionally trained maritime archaeologists and coral conservationists. These people are firefighters. We are doctors, nurses, in some cases, you know, just everyday people that are really interested in uncovering our history and heritage underwater. Every year, Diving with a Purpose runs two major programs. One is for adults off the coast of Key Largo, where we train maritime archaeology skills to individuals who are recreational divers that want to learn more. And then there's a youth program run by the National Park Service in collaboration with them at Biscayne National Park, which does the same project, but for youth, some as young as 16 years old. And those youth put tanks on their back, dive underwater, learn how to map a shipwreck, and then take those skills with them if they enter into careers in marine biology in the future, or hopefully in maritime archaeology.
Why do you make this point? Why is it important to involve local communities in this archaeological work? And what about the effort you make in conservation?
Yeah, you know, I think it's critical that we constantly are training our replacements. I tell people that my goal as a professor, as an archaeologist, is to become irrelevant. There should be so many people out there that I no longer need to do this work because there are others that are able to continue this legacy forward. So that's really a major push in what I do. And the projects that we work on, we make sure that there is a training component to that end. We also think that it's important for us not to just identify the negative things that have happened in our history, but to begin to offer some form of restitution when we begin to uncover these stories. So for example, in St. Croix, where we're working currently, in the Virgin Islands, we know that coral was mined to build these buildings, and it damaged not only the coral reefs themselves, but all of the marine ecosystems that were connected to that. So what we're trying to do now while we're doing this archaeology and learning this history is actively engage in coral conservation research so we can begin to rebuild these communities and these ecologies that we know were destroyed during the period of slavery.
Mm. Aaliyah, you know, the story of slavery is so horrible and brutal, and you set words to it. I'm just wondering, is this history traumatizing for you as a writer, as a poet? Oh, Aaliyah, we can't hear you if you're on mute.
Oh, sorry. There we go. Thank you again. I think it's interesting that you asked that because I think I've already dealt with the traumatizing pieces because that's what's in the history books. That's what we see in movies and media constantly. This was an opportunity to actually look for joy and look for people within the story. And I actually was really proud because in West African tradition, they typically have a historian, a storyteller, and that is called the griot. So the griot is this repository of an oral tradition. Typically, he is often the leader within this community. So the storytellers of these griots, they told stories, the story about gods, goddesses, war, battle, heroes, and there was no written language. So this would be done through music and dance and song, and these stories are what kept the ancestry and the history alive. And so for me, this actually felt like a joyous experience because I was able to incorporate aspects of the griot, this West African tradition, into a present day podcast. Mm. And that doesn't get to happen very often, this connection. So as hard as it was to sift through so much information, because again, right, we're still have to go through the tumultuous, just information and horrific information and the crimes. But this was a different experience that I was able to embark into, and it was beautiful.
Well, Aaliyah and Justin, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Justin Dunavant, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at UCLA, Aaliyah Pierce, Spoken Word Poet, National Geographic Explorers. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.